Okay, so I'm a theoretical physicist. I came here a few years ago, actually, when I was doing quantum field theory in the early universe. But actually, I thought at that time that, a few years later, that though it was very interesting and a great education, it was a field that was sort of dead. It was not going anywhere very fast. There was no way to see if you're right or wrong in terms of experiments. And because of that, I started getting interested in other things that personally, as a person, rather than necessarily as a trained scientist, had interest in. And I think sort of that it has to be true that one of the greatest problems in science is to understand the brain and how it works. And I think this is why we're all here. And this takes many different ingredients, including, as you saw yesterday, understanding the biology, understanding much of the anatomy and some of the biological processes at finer scales. But also, the goo is so complicated. I'll tell you a little bit more about many of these processes, but I cannot do justice to the biology. But the biology is so complex, so complicated, so full of exceptions, so full of diversity and variety, that we keep on learning more and more and more about it, that it doesn't seem feasible to ever come to understand the brain without having an idea of what it is and what it does at some sort of larger scale. So this talk is sort of a mixture of things. I think we're still getting to know each other, and I may probably fail at doing each one of them well, but I think the organizers wanted me to talk to some work I've done some years ago, which is the title, on how you identify little information processing structures from data. This is data in vitro, but it could be any other data. But in the beginning and towards the end of my talk, I'll try to make more general points. In the beginning of my talk, I'll be talking about information. So that's obviously another ingredient that you need to have in mind when you think about the brain. What the brain does, to a large extent, is to remember and process information about the physical world and about the body. And so how does it do that? We have nothing in technology that approaches the level of sophistication and self-organization and learning that exists in nervous systems. Though in many respects we're approaching the technological, I'll try to make this point more clear towards the end of the talk, we're approaching sort of the technological raw numbers to be able to maybe simulate the brain in terms of memory, in terms of speed, in terms of number elements. So what we're missing is really, in my opinion, is really a picture, a quantitative picture, a theory, if you will, of what the brain is, so that we can actually start building one. And we're building one. So let me start from the beginning, and then you'll see, hopefully, that I'll get towards these larger questions towards the end, and then I'll leave you hanging there. And hopefully those will become some of the grand challenges that we keep returning to. So that will be sort of my general plan. So what you see here, two, I think, beautiful pictures. The first one, certainly on the left, is very beautiful, and it's one of the canonical first pictures. I think this is part of the hippocampus by Golgi, who was the first person to be able to stain tissue and start to see what was there. So this is about just over 100 years ago. This is the lab I was working with, which is not very sophisticated by today's technological standards of what kind of things you can do. But just to give you an idea, this is basically a chip with multi-electrodes that's implanted on top of a petri dish where neurons grow. And you can basically start to get network information from all these neurons. And now this is done increasingly in vivo with much larger arrays. So this is one technique. And as you know, many of you have worked with other forms of measuring the brain. And so the technology has just been exploding. So there's a lot we can measure about the brain, not everything, but a lot. And it begs the question how to make sense of it. At this point, people even were still arguing whether they were neurons, whether it was all sort of just a big soup of things, et cetera. So let me get to that. So the first thing, I'll make a general point, which is both provocative, but I think it's also important to keep in mind. For me, it's sort of one of the guidelines of when you go into this very complex field with a humongous literature that you'll never know everything about. You should, I think, keep in mind, depending on your objectives anyway. I'm interested in understanding what the brain is sort of informationally, computationally, ultimately what it does. I am interested in biology, but more in terms of what it does functionally. So if you have been interested in anything in computational neuroscience, I think, or in vision, David Marr's book in the early 80s was basically a landmark of trying to establish actually a coherent narrative of what vision as sort of a mathematical information processing dynamics was. And, you know, he had his own personal story. This also came in the story of the field at MIT, where Minsky and others were developing some of the first neural networks. And Marr was coming, you know, in the sense of trying to bring together mathematics and biology. So it's a very interesting, fertile both place and time. And, but he says the following. So this is sort of the mantra that, in some sense, I'll just read it. An algorithm is likely to be understood more readily by understanding the nature of the problem being solved, rather than by examining the mechanism or the hardware in which it is embodied. So this resonates with the points we're trying to start to make yesterday. You may disagree with this, but if you disagree with this, you should have your own argument. So, and then there's the example of flight, for example, in which, of course, it was by understanding what flight is, namely the hydrodynamics of air across a wing, that we were able to build machines that do so, rather than to mimic the biology. So the idea, this may just feel like it's a theoretician's point of view, but actually it comes with a methodological idea behind it, namely that the hardware and the software, to use your word, John, actually can be very variable. You can implement computation in many different ways in general. But, and his opinion, and I guess mine, is that it is actually in the computational theory, in the principles of what the system is doing, that you may expect to have the greatest simplicity. So it is there that you may want to try to look for what a theory is. And so this, we'll come back to this, but just in case. Okay. Yes. Well, the point in general. Yeah. Well, the point is very practical, is that there could be a gazillion forms of hardware in which you can perform computation with different trade-offs of speed and energy and other things. Yeah, it's not true necessarily that there is a computational theory of cognition. It may be that different creatures are very different in the way they ultimately solve their problems. But I think if all of us here, I presume, if we think that we have a chance of talking to each other, then I think we hope that there are at least some generality to that. And so I think that that's actually the central problem of perhaps not a biological neuroscience, but certainly of people who look at the brain and want to understand what it does functionally. Is what is it? Yeah.
Yeah, so the classic example is, you know, we probably delayed flying airplanes for a century because we thought it was better.
Yeah, that. Right. So there it is, right?
Yeah. That's exactly. So just to say that thing last little bit was that what we understood was lift drag propulsion and most importantly control. And until we understood that, we actually didn't understand birds either. So we misunderstood birds, we didn't understand bumblebees, we didn't understand fruit flies. And
right.
Until we understood the principles, we didn't understand them either, nor could we build airplanes. And so it's
right.
It's a historical fact that you can get distracted by implementation.
Right. But absolutely. A wing of an airplane is in many ways very similar to a wing of a bird, but it's made out of very different things. But it performs the same function at the level of the hydrodynamics of air going through. So that's the point, you know. Often the simplicity and the ultimate function is in some sense in understanding those principles rather than in the implementations. And this is, you know, most people who thought very hard about this, them on the theoretical side, tend to think that way. Most people that actually spend a lot of time with biology tend to think that there's so much to know that we have no chance yet. We have to know a lot more. But I'll come back to that towards the end a little bit. So one of the things I wanted to introduce in the spirit of this being sort of a, it's not a tutorial, I'll confess, but in the sense of this being at least a little didactic, is this idea of information written large, not just specifically in terms of information theory, though later on I'll use information theory much more. In a much more pedestrian way. But just this idea of what are complex systems doing, and in particular the brain being perhaps the ultimate informational complex system, what is it that, how is it that it does in the sense of the theory that we have of physics, and how did this concept of information come about? So it's actually interesting because certainly I'm a physicist, not all of you are physicists, some are biologists, some are control theorists, some are other things, mathematicians. But in physics, it comes through the back door. I like to think that information actually is sort of the neutrino, if you know that story. The neutrino is what people could not see in high energy particle reactions for a while. It sort of came in to fill in a gap. So there was basically for a long time, so people were dealing with very practical problems of trying to make engines efficient, things like this. And just because economically and practically that was very important. And so finally they started assuming, and several people did this, but probably this is attributed to Helmholtz, that energy should be conserved. And if it should be conserved, it should account for each one of its sort of components, work, heat, and other things. So if you wanted to explain that and explain that machines were very far, in fact, these things were very far from being 100% efficient, as most combustion engines are, then you have to account for this loss. And this loss was eventually attributed to work that was unavailable and sort of the first way in which was basically mathematized by Clausius. But there's basically this idea that there's dissipated heat that's lost, and then there's work, which is what you want, which is the useful product. So the question really was from the beginning, can we make this better? Can you get rid of this dissipated heat, and basically make, therefore, the conversion of energy to, in some form, to work, more closer to 100%. So if you do that, then you have to deal with what is happening to this stuff that's just leaving the system, not in the form of work. And what is it in terms of microstates? So this was interpreted eventually by all these people. They're very famous in physics. Many of them actually were interested in problems of society and other things. But it's sort of interesting to think that we think of them as such purists in physics and so central to the basis of statistical mechanics. But to a large extent, they were looking, particularly Maxwell and Gibbs to a less extent and Boltzmann too, at problems of general statistics of all kinds of things. A little bit in the British tradition. So finally, Boltzmann identified this with the number of degrees of freedom in some system. And then if you take the log is important because multiplicative processes become additive under the log, and that's sort of the property of this magical quantity entropy. So entropy really has always been, from this perspective, an undesirable quantity, something that you generate when you run physical processes. But in the 20th century, this kind of took a turn for other reasons. And these reasons were basically because people wanted to understand signals that were statistical. And so one of the points that has come up in several ways, which you can take very strictly, or you can take just as to be on the back of your mind, is that you can do computation in many different things. And Alan Turing and Shannon were all basically, they became versed in these problems, again, for very practical considerations. They were trying to break codes or build codes that were unbreakable, or close to unbreakable, at least try to put a bound on what it would take to break them. So people are trying to understand how computation was done and how you could interpret a signal. Now, the theory that came out of that, in terms of information theory, so first there's this issue that computation is universal. If you're just interested in the computation, you can do the same computation using, there are many examples, cogwheels, neurons, billiard balls, all kinds of things. So there are many, many examples, cellular automata, you name it. It's very easy to have sort of a universal Turing machine, so to speak, which is a system that could, in principle, compute any computation that any other computer could compute. So that leaves you with an issue of, indeed, the implementation. It's just a way of formalizing that, but it's very important. And then finally came this breakthrough that was sort of in the making all the way from statistical mechanics of information theory and communication. And so it was the idea of trying to quantify how much information, how much there was there to predict, so to speak, in a signal. And the signal is to be seen statistically in terms of probabilities. That's what these PIs are. And then I'll show you later what these PIs might be for neural systems and how you might read their message, so to speak. And usually in this tradition, H is the symbol that's used for the Shannon entropy, though in statistical mechanics usually is S, but I'll use them a little bit interchangeably. I apologize for that. It's probably good to have that flexibility. And finally, people continue to formalize this. This is problematic because you have to be able to estimate these probabilities, and you cannot always do it well in practice. But then there were ideas of algorithmic complexity, namely to think of information the other way around, as a generative process. So if you think about how much do I need to specify to build a pattern, a number, an image, whatever it is, then that's this idea of algorithmic complexity, which is actually hit by these three people very independently. They are three interesting characters, Kolmogorov, of course, being probably the best known of them. But it's this idea of a minimum prescription length. But this, too, is problematic, because then you have to be able to build a minimum of a code. So for example, a machine code that prints out a number that you desire. There are many ways, again, to do that. That has to do, in part, with this issue of the software. And it's the minimum one that you want in order to have a bound on this sort of quantity. But you can show that these things are essentially equivalent. And they're very important for issues of whether logical systems are complete and all kinds of things that were raised by Turing. But that takes us in a different direction. So finally, where we are is that throughout this history that's more recent, but now even a little bit ancient, this puts information as a genuine quantity. But in some sense, this tradition ignores other constraints, like energy. On the other hand, sort of the 19th century tradition of physics is that there is a certain amount of information, if you wish, or of disorder that's created by physical processes. And in some sense, what complex systems are doing is that they live with all these constraints. They basically, in some sense, if they want to live long and prosper, if you forgive sort of the Vulcan salute, which is what biological systems certainly want to do, they need to deal not only with their energetics, but they need to know their environment and their own internal environment, their bodies well, in order to be able to do that. And that is an informational problem under constraints. Okay, so this just makes that point, again, in physical language, which is a very simple example. Again, you could argue with it, but this is the canonical example, which is that the way you count entropy is also built to be an extensive quantity. So what it means is that if you have a system that's extensive, meaning that effectively, not necessarily at face value, but effectively, it can be decomposed in terms of independent degrees of freedom, then you can write it in terms of an entropy that's proportional just to the number of those degrees of freedom times some number that basically counts the number of degrees of freedom per element and some constants. So there was this idea. This actually is very important because it breaks physics in a way that we don't always tell our students, I guess, which is that it introduces a certain subjectivity. It says, if you have such a system, it says, what are the degrees of freedom that you have with each element? So in the typical ideal gas, so this is now an ideal gas in a box. You probably know this, Maxwell's demons problem. So you have to choose your degree of ignorance. The degree of ignorance that we always choose, as the canonical example, is to say the particle is just somewhere in the box. I'm not going to say where. It's just in a box. I know the box. It's a macroscopic thing. But I don't know where it is inside the box. And if you do that, then you end up with this. Basically, this becomes the log of the whole volume. Okay, you've got a number. But what if you knew more? Then you end up with a different number. For example, if you could guarantee that that particle was in a subset of the volume and so forth. So this is sort of interesting because it tells you that a system that can know more about its environment, I mean, this is just a cheap example, but a system that can know more about its environment can actually, in some sense, live in effectively can process physical energy and states at lower by generating lower entropy, and by doing that it can be more efficient. So this is basically what complex systems are all trying to do. There are other theories about what complexity is and so forth. This is not a theory, it's just an argument, but it's telling you that you want to live in a complicated environment and you want to live long and do well, so you need to know about that environment, and the more you know, typically, if it's knowable, the better you'll do. So Maxwell's demon's argument is precisely that if you could actually have a demon, so this is now a supernatural creature, but it's basically a creature that knows something about the particles in this gas. And in the classical example, it just knows if the particles are hot or cold, just statistically. And then is able to select the hot from the cold ones, then it can perform work. But it can perform work out of knowing something about those particles and being able to act on that knowledge. And it turned out, I won't tell you that story, but of course later on, when people started revisiting these issues in terms of statistical mechanics and more recently in terms of quantum information theory, people had to deal with this sort of paradox. So the point is that knowledge costs you. To generate knowledge, you have to spend energy as well. And basically, the best you can do is break even at the end of the day. But there's basically this interchange between generating memory, learning, which costs you energy, and then using that energy in order to do things that the organism, that the entity wants to do in the world, which allows you to do them better. And what you see in the creation of much biology and in brains is this process unfolding in a way that is hard for us yet to describe well, but that deals with basically the acquisition of information about the world and the actions that the information then opens up. Okay, so the point about this, now there was a point yesterday about separability and coordination of elements of a system. And this point has come up also in neuroscience. There's several papers on this, also by Edelman's group and others. But this is also more or less, at least at the simplest level, it's very simple. So now let me start going into a little bit more sort of what these quantities mean in quantitative terms. This is still very simple, and then you'll see later on how I'll apply it in more detail. So basically what it means is that a system, a biological system typically, as it works, is generating a certain level of entropy, but this entropy is usually decomposed in terms of the external entropy that is exported to the environment, and its internal organization, or entropy if you wish. And so the idea is that in general you want this, the internal organization, you want to create order, or at least not destroy it. So this is less or equal than zero, which you allow to do if you export entropy to the environment. So the idea is that complex systems, what they do is that they don't deal with degrees of freedom that are completely independent, and I'll show you more about what this means exactly if you're not familiar with it. So this means that you have a system that basically what parts don't talk to each other. And the entropy is basically meant to be the quantity that separates them, that makes it additive, if that's the case. But it's also not true that this is true, which is that a part of the system, it's a little bit more subtle, that a part of the system is completely so-called redundant with the others. So what it means is that if you have, you know, two functional regions in the brain, they're not doing the same thing. But they are correlated, usually. Not always necessarily, but usually. So the difficulty in trying to understand sort of the structure and the informational structure that in the brain, or in any complex system for that matter, is that it doesn't live in these two extremes of simplicity. Things are not entirely redundant and not entirely independent. And so the question is, how do you start disentangling those parts and calling them parts that are at least, you know, functionally different? And do you have the right to do that? So I'll probably skip on this, but this is just basically Shannon's definition of entropy and where the law come from and so forth. So this is from a lecture I gave some time ago. So, let me just return to this. This makes the same point I made before. This is the definition now of what entropy is. This is the Shannon entropy typically. So this is basically an expectation value, if you look at it that way. So this is a probability over a set of states. It's the expectation value of this log. And this log has certain properties that are interesting. So if things are independent, which means in probability distributions, if probability distributions multiply, then you see that a log of a product is a sum of the logs, and that's why it becomes additive. But if they're not independent, then it's the entropy is less than that, and that's the whole point. But the part that's actually interesting, so as I told you before, the problem of entropy is that it depends a little bit on a point of view. You have to, in some sense, describe a system in terms of what it can do in terms of degrees of freedom. And that, though one can go to fundamental limits, that usually has to do a little bit about how much you can know about each part of the system. So it does bring up certain issues that are potentially methodological. However, the quantities that are really interesting are differentials, just like in physics. Everywhere in physics, what matters typically is not the quantity itself, like energy or free energy, but it's the difference of that quantity evaluated at two states. So in information, you should think about information in these terms as well. So information is not about anything fundamental. Information, as formalized in information theory, I should say, is not about knowing the weather or knowing a stock price or whatever it is that you care about. But it is about, if I give you a piece of information and you knew something before, how much more do you know? And this is a differential process. It basically describes the following mathematically. So if you have a certain uncertainty, for example, now let's start working with neurons. So if you think that you were observing a neuron, and perhaps this neuron fires, and you have some time series on its firing. So you basically get spikes or whatever it is that you are observing, but that's a good example. Then you can usually put an entropy on that time series. And now suppose you measure a neighbor neuron that you might think is connected to that other neuron. And then you ask, how much is the entropy of that neuron, so the uncertainty I have on its time series, given the knowledge of the second one? And by necessity, it's either the same, if they have nothing to do with each other, or you've gained a little bit of information. So you were able to predict a little bit better. And this differential is so-called the mutual information. This is information. And if you can generalize it, and I like to write it like this. Okay, it's not a derivative. But it basically expresses the fact that the variation of the entropy given the measurement of this auxiliary variable tells you what information is. And you can start using this formally to start disentangling a system. And that's what I'll do next. OK, so I'll skip on this because this is another point that's complicated. OK, now, so this is, again, in the spirit, this is a lot of concepts I'm throwing at you if you're not familiar with them. But there's something else that's really interesting about information, which is not just correlation. So almost all of you, I'm sure, have dealt with some sort of neural data. And you've done correlation analysis on it. Okay, correlation just tells you, in some sense, if something about the second moment, if x and y are correlated, basically, it's just about the expectation value of x, y. But what information tells you is that there are actually several forms of correlation that you can start telling from just starting to analyze patterns in space or in time of how systems behave. And I'll start showing you pictures in a bit. But I wanted you to actually think about this without showing you pictures. And so what it tells you is that, for example, in some cases, so the part that's normal and that you're familiar with is that if you know something about a variable, for example, a neuron, and then you measure another one, you may find that, and then you measure a third one. So what happens is that the third one may actually give you the same information that you already have. In that case, it's redundant. And this happens a lot in neural systems and happens in the data that I process. But this is typical that, you know, the fact that you're given some information, at some point, you recommendation systems, bad ones, used to do this. For example, if they always tell you something they already know, right? When Amazon tells you to buy a book, often you already bought it or you already looked at it and dismissed it or something. There's something there that's not capturing to do with these higher order sort of correlations that once it gives you something, you ask, is this really new information or not? But there's another limit. So that's redundancy, obviously. It's intuitive. But there's another thing that happens with information that's curious and it's very important, which is often called by the fruity name of synergy. Okay, so synergy is the fact that sometimes the third piece of information can tell you more than considering the second and the third piece of information separately. And an example that's familiar is, for example, a circuit. If you're looking at an output of an AND or an OR or your other favorite circuit, as long as non-trivial, then and your inputs are random. They come from some distribution. Let's just suppose they're 50-50. Now, I'll go through those examples later. Then you can actually compute and show that if you only compute each one of the inputs separately, you don't know the other, then you have a certain amount of predictability on the output. If you choose, for example, a very twisted circuit like an XOR, you actually have no information whatsoever. It's still unpredictable if you just measure an input and output. An XOR is when the inputs need to be different. But when you measure the second input, if it's a two-input system, you get exact predictability. Okay? So this happens generally that when you have a function of the inputs that's not a simple function, then you basically have this effect of synergy that tells you that the system, in some sense, is not coding for the same information, but together, as a function of the inputs, is processing information. It's basically telling you something new on given the set of inputs. So that's the idea here, that synergy basically gives you a larger amount of information than the sum of the parts. Independence, that's what we said before, means that each input gives you a certain amount of information. You're familiar, for example, when you study statistics and learn about IID variables and how to estimate the parameters of a Gaussian, that assumes that each measurement has nothing to do with the others that you've done before. This is typically not true when you measure real complex systems. So that's why a lot of statistics, though of course ultimately very useful, is not all that ultimately practically useful when you're doing this sort of analysis. And then there's this idea that redundancy in many cases just tells you that you've measured that before and you know it already. So the idea then is, can you start disentangling complex systems by using these ideas and create some sort of algorithm that tells you what they're made of? And the answer is that yes, and that this sort of formalism I started developing a couple of transparencies ago, which is this idea that information is related to these differentials of entropy, actually follows generally in terms of a chain rule, if you, so it's not quite calculus, but it has a lot of analogies, that you can keep on basically differentiating, if you wish, and you get of expansions that now have to do with, if I measure another degree of freedom, another neuron, how does all this actually pack up in terms of the relationships, things you measured before? And it looks sort of like that. It's just sort of math. I can walk you through it if you're interested. I'm mixing the H's and the S's. But that basically tells you, it allows you to address the issue of where the information is. So if the information is in circuits of 100 neurons, instead of in circuits of 2 neurons, that, I mean, there's something there, but there's a lot that you're influenced by in terms of many of our other neighbors if it's a circuit of 100 neurons, then this sort of treatment allows you to go in and start identifying information. So in pictures, it basically means this, that you can start with, so you proceed basically step by step. You measure a new neuron, for example. And if it's independent, you say that it's in a different group. If it's redundant, you basically mark that kind of connection as coding for the same information, though they are connected in some sense. And if it's synergetic, it means that basically that there's a more complicated relationship that's actually adding to the predictability of the system.
So, I have a question. So how does this account for the environment?
It depends what. So I've been so far probably frustratingly vague about what I mean by these X's and Y's. So you can measure whatever you want. There's in fact a way of building all kinds of, this is very generally applicable. So you can say that you have a realm of things you can measure, including variables of the environment.
So I guess okay? My question is, there are things that you might have thought were redundant and actually
aren't. Yeah, you could think so. Yeah.
So you are not saying here is my system, here is my environment,
as if we were. No. Typically, you'll see how I'll use it. I mean, you're free to use it whichever way you want, but you could just say, here's what I want to predict. And maybe, you know, it's Scott's behavior. I don't know. Okay? And then you go and say, oh, okay. I think that if I can measure Gene's behavior and John's behavior and behavior of others, I'll actually get a little closer to predicting him. And then maybe you need to know something about the environment where he is. Maybe it's KITP, he behaves differently. You know, but as long as you can measure each one of these things, you can start basically seeing how introducing each one of them tells you that that thing that you just introduced is redundant with others, and which ones is it redundant with or not. It actually produces a new synergetic piece of information, or just even an independent one that just adds information but doesn't have anything to do with others. So maybe being at KITP has nothing to do with others, but given that you're all co-organizers, probably it does have to do. There's probably either, I don't know, synergy or redundancy. So that's the point. This just gives you a constructive process to try to understand sort of where the information is about something that you want to predict. That's always the game. You basically want to predict something, and you have things you can measure. This, by the way, is something that I didn't tell you the whole history of it because I don't have time, but in fact, I have very little time. But there's a whole, there are many places where this sort of idea was used before. I've never seen sort of this expansion in the same form. But this exists in theory of optimal experimentation. It exists in several places in robotics. It exists in several places in search of stochastic signals. And so it's sort of the same idea that you basically have to search and reconstruct a stochastic signal out of parts. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Find that the first order is actually synergetic, and so you might have a little bit of
get the wrong answer from the truth table.
Yeah. Yes. So that poses then the problem, which is very practical. It's a good question, of how do you choose what to measure next, yeah. Right? So for that too, you need to have some information. Yeah. So if you measure it at random, obviously there are some things that are going to be important. Most of them have nothing to do with it. But you have to have a smart way of looking what to measure next. I won't say much about that, but there are ways to get about that. Yes. Sorry. In general, yes. But that question basically, so because these informational quantities are symmetric, it doesn't really matter at the end of the day in which order things were measured. However, there are practical issues of estimation that kind of mess you up a little bit once you get to deal with practical data. So in principle, yes. In practice, you have to watch for it. So there are issues there both ways. But we checked for that for neurons. Let me just go a little faster, maybe. And I'll be very happy to spend time with you, because I think that there's no way. What? Well, but I'm just looking at, okay. So here are some examples. You can do this with ands and ors and start basically see how it works. So in the spirit of a tutorial, if you're interested in any of these things. It's making me nervous, see? Okay, that gives me another quarter of an hour. Okay. So I'm kind of, at the moment, I'm plunging into the details of some of the things I thought I was asked to talk about, which I think are interesting methodologically. But in a minute, I'll start, resurfacing. So hopefully you'll bear with me. But remember just the general gist of this and how to use it. So, Okay. I was assuming I had to be done at 45 minutes. But okay. Because I hate when people, make me stay for double the time I need to. Okay, so these are examples I talked about you, and you can basically, if you're interested, you can work through the details and understand the mechanics of these things. And, the point is that ultimately neurons now, ends and ors, but these give you some examples of actually the information processing structures tend to be synergetic in the sense that they're functions of inputs, non-trivial function. For example, simple cells in V1 are essentially ands. And complex cells in V1 are typically kind of ORs. So that gets you a little bit into some of the things that you start seeing functionally in neural ensembles. But we don't know a lot about what these functions are ever in neural systems. And so the question is, how do you discover them? So I'll skip on this. This is just for my papers, and you can work through all these examples. But the point is that you can use this quantity R, which is basically measuring if something's synergetic or redundant, and this is very hard to see, but basically you can start disentangling what would be network structures in terms of their properties, their informational properties in terms of being two and three connections, whether they're synergetic or redundant or independent. And so this is what we've done, and the point about doing this is that I was very bothered I work partly at the Santa Fe Institute, and so there's been a lot of networks there and almost everywhere else. And it's been a question and of course networks have been used a lot, complex networks now, in terms of trying to capture the structure of complex systems and seeing that it's non-trivial and it's heterogeneous. And all that is good. But there's the question of, if you think about a neural network, a living one, or any other complex system in terms of a network, does that capture what even the function at the lowest level of the system is? Can it capture it? Or not? When you usually estimate a network, you're estimating a set of connections. You're not saying what they're doing. And the point about doing this was to start looking at dynamics of neurons, which I'll do in a second. I'll show you some of that. This is a little bit anachronic, and I apologize for it. But this is just to show you that we apply to build networks. And then, but then you start seeing that there are these structures that are not just two-point, they're not just iadic, but there are things that are actually connections that are different from just iadic connections, that you have to say something about what the function in the node is of all the inputs. And these functions are essentially not just a simple matrix that you'd write for a network. There's more to it than that. So what we did in this first paper was to basically use these relationships to prune out the network somewhat and start to say that some of these connections are actually three-point-like or four-point-like, or to eliminate some of them that are redundant. And so you end up with some network structure that you can argue about or not. You can see the strength of these connections. These connections are now expressing basically the predictability that a neuron has on another, and has typically this exponential falloff, which is sort of interesting. This is just in the nature of the strength of the weights. We've also shown in a separate paper that I won't talk about that these also decay with distance. But in these preparations, we only have about a millimeter, so it's very hard to say much about that. And these are artificial preparations. They're not the real brain. But they reassemble and resort themselves. And in these Well, you know, I don't think that's worth our time, right? So, okay. So,
this is real data?
It's real data. This is data from culture. So I'm sorry, it's all about anachronic. I added this. Yeah, so these are neurons that we measure. So I was not going to show you these slides, and then I just added them in as you came in. So these are real neurons in a culture. And we have many of these, and we can have measurements for hours that I'll show you about. Let me just show you that. What the preparation is. So here's the preparation. It's basically the figure I showed you to begin with. These are sets of electrodes. These little dots here are electrodes that live over culture. These are dissociated cultures of rat neurons. Some of them are cortical neurons. Some of them are spinal cord neurons. The structure of the time series that you get are actually quite different depending on what kind of tissue you get. These are harvested around birth. And so for these animals, it's sort of interesting that there's sort of a the procedure to build these preparations is very different from the brain. You basically take neurons from a part of the brain, as I described. You dissociate them both enzymatically and through centrifugation. This basically separates the neurons. You plate them, and after about 2 weeks being plated, the neurons reconstitute themselves as a network. If they don't do so, they die. These networks typically, so this is about a millimeter square in reality. This is a millimeter square here. The preparation is a little bit bigger. So what you measure here, basically, it's hard to estimate exactly, but these preparations have something between hundreds and maybe hundreds of thousands of neurons. And what you do is that you measure the signals, the local field potentials, so just the local potentials that exist in parts of the preparation here. And so these measured, so typically you have, these were preparations, I think, with 64 electrodes. Probably can count them. Maybe there are more of them. We've worked also with ones with 128, and now people are doing this with 512 and 1024 and perhaps more. And increasingly it's being done in vivo, though you can imagine the difficulties of doing this in vivo and the conditions under which it can be done. But for example, I'm talking a lot with Bill Newsom, who's got beautiful results like this from monkeys. Under, you know, real-life motor visual tasks. But so the idea here was just, you know, to have a method to look at these sort of signals. So what you have here is basically a very low sample of the neurons that actually exist in tissue. Even here, in vivo, it's just incredibly worse. And so what happens then after that is that the signals that are extracted from each one of these are basically spike sorted, so to speak. So that means that basically there are spike shapes that are identified by the electronics and software, and then they're sorted, they're attributed to different neurons. So because of that, you can usually get different shapes per electrode. You can end up with more than those 64, up to typically that times 4. So what you get for cortex is this sort of time series. This is, note the scale, this is basically 40 seconds. And this I am told, but some of you may know better, this is basically typical of cortical tissue. And this is immature cortical tissue. If you just looked at this and didn't know where it came from, you might think it's quite epileptic. It's what you find here, so these are different neurons. And what you find here is that these are, all the neurons tend to basically fire, it's stochastic, but often to fire together. That's why you see these stripes. And you see that different neurons have slightly different rates and so forth. So if you then zoom in, you start seeing more detail in each one of these. So I'm just zooming in time in each one of these events. These are called sometimes network bursts. Some people like to call them avalanches, an analogy to other complex systems. There's a whole discussion about that that may interest some of you, I suspect. But anyway, I won't say much about that. So when you look inside each one of these, they're actually quite stochastic. So they're very variable, and each neuron fires at different times, and you get this sort of signal. So the question is, this is messy. It's very stochastic. Can I predict this very complicated little time series from measuring something else about the system? That was all we were doing. Yeah.
So you've got 64 sensors,
yeah.
but because they have slightly different waveforms associated with the environment of each one of these sensors, you can get more than 64 computers.
That's right. That's right. Because each action potential is fairly stereotypical, that's an assumption, but let's say it's true. And remember that also you're picking up from the field. You're not measuring intracellularly. It's all extracellular recording. So what you and often you might pick up a signal from a dendrite or from an axon or from a cell body, depending exactly where you are relative to the cells around it. So there are shapes of these action potentials that you then use. And typically, this is true that you can distinguish them. There are different shapes that you can get from each point in space. And there's a spike sorting algorithm that basically a template matching. You select it, and that you get different neurons.
So sorry, then
yeah.
You kind of get four ones you can
yeah.
For sure, and then
yeah.
A bit junk or something like that.
If you're lucky, you usually don't get four for each one of them, unless you're at very high densities. And often, you know, very rarely, it's very cute because you end up measuring the same neuron at different points. So you actually see that, you know, that thing is always giving you a signal that goes together. So, but this, you know, our estimate, our rough estimate, is that you're covering perhaps 5% or a few percent of the number of neurons that exist in the preparation. When you do this in vivo, it's much worse because there are, of course, a lot more neurons and it's three-dimensional and so forth. But also these math, you know, obviously the number of electrodes and spike sorting algorithms are getting better, but obviously they're still limited to a number of order of a few thousand, let's say, at the most. But this is the most detailed sort of network information you can get. You can get then, I would argue, you can get the network information at larger scales from other imaging methods. And you can get also then intracellular recordings, typically of a cell or maybe a few more, but typically not of a network. So this sort of lies in between, you know, very detailed electrophysiology and larger scale methods. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a set of other techniques. They're all coming online. I don't know exactly what time and temporal scales and so forth that allows you to do. But so there are other things you can do. A lot of these preparations, because they're not real brains, that dissociated culture, so to speak, are used to study, for example, pharmacological preparations. So you can just see what kind of things is toxic or not to these neurons. But what we were trying to do, which we never succeeded in doing, there was a claim from Israel, but I don't think they're right, and several people tried to do this, is to use this as real brains in the bottle that you could train, much as you train an artificial neural net. And to see if these networks, given certain inputs, you know, that would be commensurate, some learning rule could actually start structuring themselves. I think that this is probably possible, but you have to hit it. Right. There's a period of development in vitro that's about 14 days. If you don't hit them there, then probably the biochemistry that you get in vitro is not rich enough to allow you plasticity anymore. But all that's speculative. Okay, so. But much to talk about there. So there are a lot of labs now that do these, and they've tried to play with them in interesting ways. So the point is that you can start building networks out of these and try to see what they do. So what I want to tell you a little bit more about then is how do you identify these several information processing modules or subgraphs, or perhaps motifs, as they're so often known, and how do you proceed with the kind of algorithm that I was starting to describe to you. So there's been sort of very interesting work by Uri Alon's group and others now from a few years ago. There was a paper in Science that generated a lot of enthusiasm on this idea that if you have networks, you can start identifying motifs in these networks, and you hope that these motifs have some functional meaning, something about what those elements, whatever the nodes are doing. And the procedure is supposed to be just statistical. You identify basically a certain number of nodes, and then you write down all the possible network structures that you can have between them. So if it's directed, you can have, for example, 13 for three nodes. And the problem we do, and so then the idea is that you measure these on a network that you inferred from spiking neurons or from gene expression or whatnot. And then you ask, if you randomize that network, do these things appear in excess or in deficit of what you might expect on the average? And if it varies significantly, you might say, this thing appears very frequently, it must be doing something. And then you can try to model what that is. The problem, if you think for a fraction of a second, is that, of course, these things explode combinatorially. And you cannot just look for them as you go up in numbers of elements. So, for example, so they're the numbers, basically. It's impossible to start following these to higher numbers. So you need to have a smarter way of looking for them. And so I already showed you about this and the data. So the idea is, if you're going to build circuits that describe this sort of data, and unfortunately this data was not in vivo, but you could do similar things, then you have to basically have a way of adding motifs as you go, so to speak. You cannot search extensively, exhaustively. So the idea was to start looking at these systems from this point of view of information theory. Probably the pioneering sort of work, at least in modern times, is Bialik's and collaborators' book called Spikes, but there's a lot that happened after that. But if you're interested in introductory text, that's not bad. Most of their work in this text is about one neuron, and they work a lot with the fly, because Rob de Reuter basically is an expert in fly visual neurons. But basically the idea is that you have to start building states, and this brings us a little bit with some of the practical considerations that I was starting to describe. So from those time series you just saw, you can start building states that correspond to whether the neuron fired or didn't fire over a certain interval. You could think of building different kinds of states, but that's what we've done and that's what is usually done. And you can build these as collective states, so across neurons in the vertical and across time in the horizontal. And that is the way in which you end up estimating these probability distributions. You can do a better job if you can start having priors and doing some other sort of learning, et cetera. But basically the mechanism is that you have to build a statistical state as to how a neuron fires in a way like this. And if you do that, then you apply this sort of decomposition. And if you do this now is some of the questions that came up. For example, this is neuron, I think, 47. And you can start seeing how its entropy, so its variability in how it fires, is explained in terms of other neurons. And so you can basically build a truncation of that series, that was your question, to some order. And what that means is that you measure something about how neurons relate at low orders, and you use that to guide your choice of what to measure next. So that then gets onto the choice algorithm. There are several ways of doing this, and I'd like to talk to you about that if you're interested, but it gets too technical. So basically, because this is small, we could even do exact, and this is the sort of pattern that you get. You basically see that its entropy, normalized to 1, is basically reduced as you measure more things, as it had to be. But basically, there are a few neurons that have a lot to say about that neuron, and then the rest seems to be in sort of very diffuse across the network. And if you put together this in terms of synergy and redundancy and so forth, you find that most neurons tend to be redundant with other neurons, but a few, the red and blue mean that, a few are essentially also synergetic. So as before, the synergy, which is now to many orders, is basically contained essentially in terms of smaller numbers of groups, and there's a lot more redundancy. This may be because of the preparation, but it may be that indeed neural populations have these properties. We don't know that. It's just an application to the data. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that people have done with certain people saying finding a larger number than average, even I agree about the computational issue, but let's the paper's mostly going to be on 3D
versus 4 anyway. Because of that. Yeah.
But let's suppose that weren't a problem and you only need to worry about three or four neurons.
Yeah.
They are making global statements, whereas you could find a situation where one part of the network is overrepresented and another part of the network is underrepresented. In fact, you would expect in many situations to find something.
Sure.
So here you're talking about, so similar philosophically, you're talking about globally redundant ensemble. Is there any reason to believe that I can think about global redundancy to be more than local redundancy or rank group, regardless of the formal
redundancy? You could make that restriction if you wanted. You could make a distance restriction. So if you say a neuron is somewhere, you know, it's a node in a network, you just say that's that one. Then you could say, as I measure these, and you can organize them via distance or via some lower level measure of information, do you have on them some correlation? Then you could start saying how much information they give you about that one, therefore the entropy reduction.
Whether defining trying to look at the global properties is more
relevant to the actual question, or looking at local version of the property, or looking at principle, right. Defining the one. I think this goes to a question that came up in Helen's talk yesterday, which is what's far and what's close. And in here, because our preparation is essentially small, of order a millimeter square, that's considered quite local in any neural system, including these.
Okay,
so there's no...
That system doesn't have a particular problem.
In this sense, there is, though we do find a weak but systematic dependence on distance, that two neurons are supposed to be more informative of each other. It's still probably something that you need to probe over larger distances. But in general, in principle, that's true, of course, what you say. But you have to think about what is the typical scale and whether you can probe it by organizing information spatially. But in general, yes, sir. Yes. Yeah. No, sorry. They can, but these are all cortical.
These are all
Yeah. We've looked also at spinal cord neurons. They're very different in their patterns of firing.
And was it 14 days clean
data or post-clean data? So I believe that they're extracted from fetuses just before birth, I think a few days before birth, and then they typically stay in vitro. They have development in vitro that you're probably familiar with the preparation, typically for about 2 weeks. But it's a little bit, at that point, usually they are connected. People have measured them throughout, but they usually start only showing spiking around 2 weeks. But again, this is slightly density dependent as well. So if it's higher density, I think you start seeing them a little earlier. And then after that, in about 3 weeks, between 2 and 3 weeks, the network is mature in the sense that looking at them by eye in terms of what they look like under the microscope, but in terms of their firing patterns, doesn't change a lot anymore. And then some of these can live for 6 months, but they often get contaminated when you start doing something to them. Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
But what is it telling us about the fundamental properties of the brain? Because in some sense, you know, if you use the statistical measures, you can apply to my coffee cup, to a bunch of cells,
yep.
To my bicycle,
yep.
I will get a plot of this kind. But what is really important?
Not all systems, but yes, okay. But I take your point. Yeah.
That's completely how you're trying to separate the whole system, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You can go back to people at Obelisk, the sync fire chains, you know.
Well, it's not exactly the same, but sort of some of the ideas are similar. Yeah. No, but what I've done is different because it includes these larger groups. Well, but that's the point. Yeah. Well, I'm sure we all do colorful pictures, but there are several things. Great. But those are different days, right? I did too. Look, these, I said from the beginning, these are dissociated cultures, so I cannot tell you all that much about the brain. However, before you say anything else, it's my turn. What this does, what I wanted to show from the beginning, is that there are, from the point of view of informational relationships, how might you predict the behavior of a part of the system, in this case a neuron, has structure. That information about that neuron is structure in terms of some of these groups of other neurons that have interrelationships that are functional and others that are exchangeable one for another, at least in part. So that is redundant versus synergetic structures. That's all I wanted to show, really. Okay? And this has not been done in the earlier work, though obviously many of the methods are there, up to a few neurons and so forth. So in Bialik's group, I've cited them, as you see. They had started doing some of this, but not to the same level of disentangling these several neuronal groups together. Now, what you get out of it, obviously to you, it doesn't seem like I get much. I was happy that you could do some of these disambiguations of where the information essentially is in the system, and the fact that if you have redundant structures, this is much more like, as you mentioned, synfires or synchains, that essentially the information, and this is part of the inspiration for us, that you basically have information that can be traveling across a series of neurons. And in that sense, it's redundant. If you measure it here, if you measure it later, if you measure it later, it's saying the same thing. And this is let me finish. And this is basically a mechanism for short-term memory. So that has essentially a flavor of being a redundant structure in this language. Whereas if you have something that is actually giving you an output from inputs that you cannot predict by using each one of the inputs separately, then you have another structure. That's it. Yeah. Yes. 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 Yes.
Your entry measures will not be able to distinguish those in the way you apply them now.
Well, that's not true. That's not true because. Well, okay. Right. So it depends on the state space and how you define it. Agreed. But you can certainly define, as I showed you, sequences of where the spike comes in time. So if you use those, there's information in that sequence as well. Now, you can fight over exactly how to do it and whether using spikes is the best way to do it or if I should organize it in some other way. But the treatment is perfectly general. The state space, as in Meron's question, I think, there are issues of practicality as to what are the states and how do you define them. I totally agree. But please don't miss the forest for the trees. The point is that what I'm trying to show you is that even at a small scale, there are things in these neural networks that are information processing-like and things that are memory-like. So they're not all synfire chains. OK. So let me just then, I'm doing horribly with time, so. Yeah, and that's also true that when you look, yeah, right, that's also true. So, but I was thinking about basically structures that, at least in some version, were argued to be mechanisms for short-term memory in that cells would be along some chain, and they basically would be holding on to the same information that could return. So anyway, you can do more statistics of this and see how many you have and what the group sizes are and so forth. This may not be interesting in the sense that it's a preparation of the kind that it is. I just want to show you that you started basically with something that was quite random, and you end up explaining, at least to the eye, it looks quite random, and by any measure of entropy of a single cell channel. And this basically tells you that you can explain much, and these are for different cells, it's a histogram for each one of the cells in the preparation. You can basically explain most of the normalized final entropy, which is of order 1, in terms of the other cells in the system. So, and you learn basically under what structures that appears. So for instance, an example for a particular cell, there are all these little groups that basically are redundant with each other, so they're largely interchangeable with each other. And there's basically a group that has also cells that are interchangeable with other cells. But this group basically is what is the synergetic part of it. So you could think of it as being a little circuit, and these are basically our redundant components. So here's neuron 46, our favorite neuron. Okay, it has a time series. And these are all the other neurons, I believe, in the preparation. And what you find here is that through the methods I described, there's a set of neurons that form a synergetic group. So these basically have this character that, taken together, they predict much more than taken separately. These other neurons all form other groups that are redundant with each other in some cases, or just stand by themselves. And these also feed into 46. So each one of these So the character of these groups within themselves is different. These are redundant and these are synergetic. However, there are neurons in here that you can, they are redundant with other neurons here. So it's complicated, but it's interesting. You can reconstruct it.
What does it mean functionally? What does it tell me about how the brain works?
I'll get back to that. I told you that I would go into the depths of things. This tells you that a cell, even a cell in these damn very simple preparations, already has structure input. They didn't learn from anywhere. It was just self-assembled in the bottle. Where this cell is not entirely redundant with other cells. It has groups that basically form. They are redundant with each other. And that creates some input to the cell, and they're redundant with it. And other groups, they're basically function-like. They basically, so these are structures that, putting bigger words to it than the formalism, these are structures that could hold information in that different parts of the system contain the same information as they fire. You can measure one or the other. And these are groups that basically are functions, so more like a circuit. They're things that basically together determine the firing of 46.
Mm-hmm. 46 obviously has all these connections with everything else.
Yeah.
And then maybe you've got like 24 connected over there or whatever, showing something about these people, but you're not showing anything connected to anything else. So sometimes
you're just
the local environment.
Yes, yes, yes.
So there's like 51, 41, 12 are redundant with each other.
Yeah.
So redundant with 46?
Yeah, because it's symmetric.
Why are the vast majority redundant?
Yes, as I showed you in those plots of statistics. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So there's
Yeah. Yeah. And with themselves together with 46. Yeah. Exactly. This is just to show you that even in these very simple preparations, if you care about how the information is determined, well, the brain, I'm sure qualitatively, but there's already a lot of structure. That if you want to predict, if you wanted to build a model for one of these neurons or for the network of neurons, okay, you would have to account for different input structures. You know, these neurons form a certain form of input to that neuron that's different from some of these other ones. There's something there that's not just simply writing a network of connectivity. There are these little functions that come into the fore that you need to take into account. What? I think they're more determinant of the firing, I believe. I think this is the same neuron here. Let me just check. So that's 42 is the most informative neuron. I mean, I'm not saying it's the nicest picture that you could draw with this, but it's to show you that there are these different elements that you cannot just go in and say, I know what a neuron is. I know, you know, I'm going to put a bunch of input currents, I'm going to prescribe that network structure, and that by itself might not be enough. You need to prescribe something that has functionality, and this may be in a dendritic, I don't know if this is part of a dendritic tree or its own circuit that somehow imposes this sort of relationship or what it is. But even at these very simplest level, there are sort of different groups of neurons that have different informational functions at the simplest level you could define them. Yes? I think as you build your network, you know, so there are currents that come into the cell, each cell, right, that depend on the connectivity that you'd have for each one of the inputs, right? So you'd have some parameters there to be prescribed, right? So what this says is that in some sense, those inputs are not independent. They form these, informationally, these structures. How they come about, you know, as you estimate them, they basically have these structures. They're not just iadic.
Well, but those neurons, like 30, 24, are allowed to synaptically connect to each other.
Yeah.
So maybe that's how they interact.
So sure, but the question is,
what is the question?
What is the question? The question is that, the answer is that, the question is, where is the information? If you want to predict the behavior of a neuron, okay, and everything's made out of neurons and synapses, right, then can you just take into consideration other neurons separately? Should you do that? Or should you start thinking that actually they have certain functional groups that are doing something about predicting that behavior? Okay?
I'm sorry, but I don't understand what that means. Suppose I just build a network of integrated fine neurons.
Yeah.
And in each case, it's just pairwise connection from neuron A to neuron B.
Right.
With a different weight.
Right.
And all the inputs are summed in the neural growth up and that threshold.
Right. Right.
Are you saying that that's not a correct model, and that model would not be?
Yeah, depending on how you write the input current, if you just write as the sum of those weights times the inputs, I don't think you'd reproduce these patterns of behavior.
Even though those other neurons can actually connect with themselves?
I cannot exclude that there's some scenario in which they would create a circuit like this. That's why I'm not saying that black and white. But I don't think you could do that way.
Okay.
Yeah. This tells you that if you did that, which we haven't done, but if you did what you two suggest, you should be able to see these structures. Okay? No, we haven't. Well, maybe you should. You're the one is interested. But, yeah. No. But the point taken. Okay, so this is one thing at a time. This is basically telling you that there are some structures in these networks as to how an output of a neuron is predicted. They have these statistical properties, okay, of being synergetic or redundant or not or independent. And these must come out of any model. If you wanted to model this network, this must come out of that. Now, these, depending exactly on what model you're going to build for a neuron, that model may basically be a model that if you build something where the output is basically statistically independent of each input given the others, that would fail at this. No, this reflects the predictability of the time series. It's not physical connections necessarily. Yes. Sure. Ultimately, everything is that, right? Yeah, but I'm telling you, you could start there. As I said, you could always start there. That by itself is not enough information. You need to know something about how the network is organized. And the network, said loosely, you basically have to have functional structures that implement certain kinds of functions. Like, for example, that little blue set of circuits. It's not statistical correlation per se. It's information, which is to all orders. And yes, I think these systems are doing information processing. If my measure is the canonical measure, what can I say?
Well, it's not necessarily some input output transformation that's important with respect to, say, a network or behavior or perception.
No, I know. Okay, look. Yes, you could pick, as I answer to your question, in general, you can pick a system with other degrees of freedom. This is what I had, okay, as data. I think it might be interesting to do that with other degrees of freedom and so forth. But this is what I had, and in a bottle, this is all you can measure, basically. So that's it. Or you can do pharmacology and so forth. But my point is, I think you're again fixating on details, and some of these details are important. But I'm telling you that if you were to build a simulation of this, you'd have to reproduce some of these input-output relationships that do not correspond to, if you build a model, which typical models may be of this form, that the output of a neuron, statistics of the output of a neuron, is conditionally independent of each one of the inputs given the others. Okay, this will not reproduce this sort of data. There's something else that's happening, okay? And whether this is some integration in the dendritic tree or something, I don't know what it is. No. I agree with the general meaning. I'm trying to answer, honestly. But But you want to understand it, you know, as we said from the beginning, information is relative to, is a subjective quantity to some extent. So that's why we're not, I'm not answering the way you want me to, and that's why you're not asking the question that I'd like you to. So. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Sort of, you know, kind of what is your null model? And is the null model for the
right.
The physical independence of every single neuron
given the others. So, yes,
yeah,
so sure.
So, is there a more sophisticated null model mm-hmm. that might produce some kind of structure because you know your algorithm is going to
Right. So, I think all these questions are very interesting and relevant. What we wanted to show in this work is simply how you might use the statistics of signals that you hope you expect to be connected with each other to extract informational relationships between them. That's all. And this is the procedure in which you might do it. So, and the fact of considering groups of varying sizes and so forth, this had not been done. And it follows from these nice properties of multi-informations. Now, what it means then becomes interesting. The reason why, frankly, I didn't chase it much more was because I wanted to have a preparation that was not just neurons in a bottle, which I'm only maybe now getting in the next few months from macaques in vivo. So I think it's some of these are fair questions. I think that, however, some of them are implicit. As you write down a model, you can exclude certain properties of that model as being able to reproduce this data before you do any simulation. So I'll be happy to talk about that further. I think that's the answer to some of your questions. But you cannot necessarily exclude that if you soup up the model, you won't be able to do something at some point that's similar. So, you know, at some point we have to get down to details about that.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to make
a yeah, exactly.
This is something on the stack.
Yeah.
Okay. So go back to like your second slot. What's the function, which I think is important here.
Right.
I think one of the things that I would be maybe a discussion off, a separate discussion you might be interested in is that I think we really understand in some real gory detail now exactly the nature of information theory. Well, it's the most beautiful theory
right.
in engineering. It's also extremely brittle.
Right. It can be. And yeah.
And, so I think one interesting discussion point would be is the function of the brain doing brain processing? I think it's clearly not.
No, it's part of it. It's part of it. It's not all of it.
I think it's very little of it.
Okay. So then we should have that discussion.
Yeah. Talk about the SAT.
Okay. Okay.
It's unfortunate because the richest theory we have available.
Right.
And the most accessible theory we have available is mm-hmm. information theory by far.
Right. But for once, I mean the usual. Major drawback in information theory, I alluded to it, but maybe just to make it totally explicit, is that it has no semantics, right? It's all relational. I look at something.
It doesn't deal with latency and
hash. Right, which.
If you look at the neural architecture, a huge amount of resources are devoted mm-hmm. to doing things fast. You just look at the main circuits. So speed in taking fast action dominates the architecture. And that's the most, that more than semantics is what's missing in the room.
That's an issue. I mean, okay, we must have that discussion. But I think that there are a lot of, certainly in mammals and humans, there are lots of informational structures. We were starting to talk about cortex yesterday, right? What is cortex? What's good for? There's a lot of it is about memory structures and things that you can, in some sense, retrieve to then perform actions that are non-local in time. But we should have that. We should exactly. So that brings a lot of questions that we're not going to solve in the next minus 5 minutes. So I just wanted. So all these questions are good. We should discuss them. But I want to zoom out a little bit in the interest of just maybe putting some of these questions on the table. So we in Santa Fe we've been organizing a couple of these meetings that I think are very resonant with the theme of this workshop. And we've been calling them Grand Challenges in Neural Computation. And they're organized specifically to get people a little bit out of, you know, very important people in the field and have done very interesting work, according to us anyway, but I think it's, but really you should go and look at the list of speakers. I think it's quite interesting. And we've had two of these, and the idea is to really ask people if at the systems level they think that we're close to understanding what neural computation is. Computation, for lack of a better word, you may use cognition, you may use other words, but and why and why not, and whether then we can build essentially some of these systems, and what would it take. And basically, the third question is more because sponsors and so forth, but it's also interesting that what technologies that may be enabled and scientific solutions that may be enabled by this. But the main question really is, are we starting to understand neural systems at the systems level, and what are they? And it's sort of very interesting because most people would say, most of the biologists that have done most extraordinary work in different levels will tell you, no, there's a lot more that we don't know, and you've got to know that before you do well. And then, of course, you have the sort of more irresponsible theorists or computational neuroscientists who basically will tell you that we know a lot. There's a lot of work and hypotheses that we can start posing and testing and that we haven't done yet. So there's really a question of starting to work on those and see if they work. So I think it's a very interesting time in the field where it's shifting away from being a completely intractable problem of thinking about how the brain might work as a whole and try to build mathematical models of that and building also then computational implementations of that that might allow you to experiment also with behavior and then with neuroscientific measurements. But this is all basically coming together. So I'll make that argument very briefly and then leave you with questions actually rather than answers. We had actually two speakers who they just have a book out. But there's a very interesting Nova series about this, and a lot of it is about magic. And you should know, for example, there's an interesting factoid, which is that do you know that kids below the age of 4 or 5 are basically immune to magic? It's very interesting. And so some of these magicians in Vegas show them basically how they perform some of their simple tricks, and they're all about your expectation about what's going to happen. You know, the coin moving or something moving and so forth. This is all about your brain basically making a prediction that in this case is false that creates a construction of reality, of your perceived reality, that is basically magic. So magic is in your head, and if you're naive, so to speak, if you're young enough, you're not quite there yet, so you're immune to it. So many things that are sort of interesting. That's the most interesting probably part of the program, and they gave a colloquium, and we also had basically these Watson had just basically won Jeopardy, thank you. And so there was the question, how did that happen? What did it do? And so forth. That was sort of interesting. So you might see now that increasingly there are these models. So this has nothing to do with the work I've talked about before, about these neurons in vitro. They have to do with large-scale models of the brain. And these usually are not models of detailed circuits. They're models that work at a higher level of abstraction, though there's an exception. For example, Blue Brain is trying to do very detailed models of cortex. Here's the rat cortex cortical column. Depending on what you think about all these things, and I think it's probably premature, they're basically just telling you that you can build models of the brain at large scale, and you can start experimenting with them to see if you're right or wrong. And what that is also a question. There are all kinds of methodological questions. We have our own little effort, which was to build a visual system. Blue Brain's very famous for trying to do this at very high levels of biological accuracy. And we were just talking about that with Lucas. And basically, there's this idea they may get a lot of money from Europe or not to do that. There's a big DARPA has been funding this sort of models for their own purposes. And IBM has a very large effort on that. It actually involves many universities. But they won the Gordon Bell Prize last year for basically running a very large neural code rather than doing anything with it, but that's something else. And I shouldn't remember that. And there are many other examples. You just see an explosion of this. It's just possible. So what was a technically intractable problem is increasingly becoming technically tractable. It's just that we don't know what these models should be. And that's another talk that I'd be happy to talk about, but I won't give. But I just want to touch on some of these issues because they came up yesterday as well. I like to, as is typical of physics, to basically just talk about this problem of scale and what are the scales that we have achieved in technology and what are the scales that are still problematic. So you might disagree with these numbers. They're basically order of magnitude, and I'm sure some of you will have issues with it, so I'll preempt it with that. But the human brain is probably something of the order of 100 billion neurons. People talk about maybe 30 billion, but and maybe 10 to the 15 synapses of that order. And if you think of what those elements are, if you think that that's what the brain really just is made out of, at least functionally, and they work at basically rates that are where you a neuron has typical time scales of a kilohertz, but they fire much more sparsely than that on the average, so maybe of the order of 100 or 10 hertz. So we're talking about a factor maybe of almost a million relative to modern computers. So this is basically where you get the difference. There's a million in speed to modern computers, roughly speaking, between the temporal rates of neurons and the temporal rates of modern computers, but essentially the brain is a million times more parallel, and that's where you gain the speed. Certainly, visual cortex and other sensory cortex. So, but the point is, sort of in the last just 2 or 3 years, there are computers now that are getting to, this is probably the computational, rough computational number of operations per second. So a petaflop is 10 to the 15 floating operations per second. And we're just getting there with the largest computers that exist today. This is our local computer at Los Alamos. This is a Chinese new computer. And this is changing quite fast. And for example, for functional areas, you probably just need a fraction of this, even if you wanted to have a lot of detail. The magical part about the brain is this 25 or something like 20 to 30 watts that it consumes. It's very expensive biologically, but relative, you know, to any of this, it's nothing. And the kind of operations that it does. And basically, all these computers consume the power of a small town or not so small town. And there's this issue of memory. This is just an estimate by basically associating it with the number of synapses. And the part that actually has been less probed, but it's most critical, I was talking to Scott about that, is this issue of, suppose you really think that you have the model for how the brain works and how it learns and how it memorizes the world and uses it to recreate new things. The amount of experience that it needs is actually very large, of course, if you think about a kid growing up. Depending what it is, of course, that varies. But for example, for visual experience, is in your lifetime, you probably see of order 30 petapixels. And there's nothing like this that was ever done. Data sets are getting larger, but basically, though you can put a computer in front of a TV, the amount of sort of supervision and interaction and to the extent that has been tried, has only been tried for maybe hours, maybe days. But there's no instance in computer vision, for example, where people really have tried to train a system with massive data sets. So there's the issue of putting all this together, if you knew what you were doing, this is just about units of things, and exposing a system to this level of experience and then see what comes out. And one of the most important questions, which I think should be a great challenge, is on the way, so if I have a 15-month-old, and he's now accelerating what he's been learning, but basically he's very slow. If you look at his motor learning, you know, language, of course, but even vision, it's very slow. It takes months, certainly in the beginning, for anything to happen. So if you did this with a computer, how would you know that it's on the way to actually be as good as a human, potentially, or as good as your other target, whatever it might be? And this is really something that there's a lot of theory of learning, both in computation and of course, in psychology. And Scott promised that you'd tell us more about his own work on that. So that's, I think, a very interesting question. And this will all be coming up soon. And so then there are these problems of what I called function. I'll close here. The problem of representation, when you look at sensory cortex, this is really what most people have been dealing with for a long time, is basically how do you disentangle this signal? So the world looks complicated by any statistical measurement. But it's only been in the last maybe 10, 15 years, and particularly now with theories of compressive sensing and other new theories of certain forms of signals, that we understand that the world is in some sense much easier in the right basis, so to speak. It's not a basis, but in the right interpretation, the right decomposition, than it used to be. It's compressible. You see that in formats like JPEG, which is just an approximation to all that. But we're learning that what you see in primary visual cortex and primary auditory cortex are actually independent components, speaking again to the sort of decomposition I was talking to, of these signals, and that the brain is able, in some sense, to be optimal at learning some of those. But there's the question of how do you learn things at higher levels built on those, and those are presumably experience-driven, not universal. This is just becoming possible, and you'll see a lot of this coming out of vision in the next few years. We'll learn a lot about the upper layers of visual cortex and what the representations are going to be there. And we'll start seeing how those compare to what we see in neuroscience. And then there's, finally, so this in some sense is the problem of information processing. What is it doing with the information it has in memory and both coming to it? What is the problem of memory? In some sense, the brain is a memory like nothing else. It's an associative memory. It's a memory that allows you to reproduce features of the world when you close your eyes. And imagine something that's a mathematically very ill-posed problem as you go from high labels to a detailed visual scene, for example. That's impossible to do mathematically unless you have very strong so-called, obviously, priors. You have information in the network that allows you to reconstruct that detail. And so these models are just beginning to be understood and constructed in terms of Bayesian graphical models of a sort. It's very interesting. And finally, there's this issue of self-organization. How does it assemble itself? So Helen's talk yesterday had very beautiful examples of this. Why does it self-assemble hierarchically? Why is it not a strict hierarchy? Is that experience-driven or not? And then how do these things change with experience? And what is the level of representation? So in visual cortex, in auditory cortex, we now think that, you know, in most realms of experience, there are sort of universal representations. They're the same for everybody. What is it that happens sort of as you go up in cortex and you deal with more and more abstract and experience-driven things? How do those representations emerge and how do they change over time? There's also a lot of evidence for very fast churn. So there's a lot of turnover. Even in those representations, they're quite general. And it's interesting to ponder why that is. So there are lots of problems at the systems level that I didn't touch on that I hope we'll touch on throughout this this meeting. I'll leave it there. I apologize for a lot of detail and a lot of vagueness, I guess, in some parts. But we're just getting to know each other, and I think that it's important maybe to touch both these things. And I hope we can follow up on some of these questions and clear them up over the next few days. Thank you.